My name is Andrea Schwartz, and you are listening to the Law and Liberty podcast of the Chalcedon Foundation. As we continue to honor the memory of Chalcedon's founder, R.J. Rush Dooney, in 2011, the 10th anniversary of his death. Many consider R.J. Rush Dooney to be the father of the homeschooling movement, thanks to his groundbreaking books on the subject of education, Intellectual Schizophrenia, and The Messianic Character of American Education. During the course of his life's work, Rush had the opportunity to work with many fine Christians who shared his perspective on education and the rights and duties of parents to decide and oversee how their children would receive an education. One such person was Shelby Sharp, who served as the lead attorney in the Leeper versus Arlington class action suit, a landmark case that settled the question of homeschools in Texas being private schools. Shelby Sharp is served as the general legal counsel for Texas Homeschool Coalition and is ready and able to respond to legal issues related to home education in the state of Texas. He has threatened legal action against school districts for violating decisions of the courts on behalf of THSC Association members. They say that when Shelby Sharp speaks, school districts listen. I recently watched a video where Mr. Sharp shared his moving story of the Battle of the Leeper case, detailing God's hand in the legal battle surrounding homeschooling in Texas. He has graciously taken time from his very full schedule to speak with me today about how Rush was a key player in the successful outcome of that court case. Shelby, during the years I knew Rush, he would mention you often, and very fondly, I might add, and I thank you for joining me.
I'm pleased to help.
Would you please summarize for us the issues of the Leeper case and then outline how you came to hear of R.J. Rush Dooney and why you selected him to serve as an expert witness?
Well, the Leeper case got started because parents were being prosecuted for not having their children in public schools. And those prosecutions were taking place in justice courts across the state. That's the lowest level of court. In fact, they're not even courts of record. And the homeschool parents were winning about half of them and losing half of them. And they were trying to figure out how could we get a resolution of this. There was a meeting of homeschool leaders in Houston to discuss what might be done in the legislature to resolve the problem. And a friend of mine asked if I would accompany him to Houston to listen to what all was being discussed. Towards the end of the meeting, somebody, and I don't know who it was, wanted to know what my thoughts were on it. And I told the leaders that I thought that the Texas statute could not be improved upon and that their resolution of the prosecutions would be better done by a declaratory judgment suit filed in state district court, where you would put all of the 1,063 school districts in the suit as defendants, except you would have them in there by representatives as opposed to naming them all, and then put the Texas Education Agency in there. And after that meeting, I came back to Fort Worth, and some people in Arlington wanted to hear more on that. And from that meeting out there, that's how the homeschool case got started. Now, moving to your question about how did I determine to request Dr. Rush Dooney's participation, I knew who he was because he and I had been involved in several meetings, not addressing homeschool issues, but just issues of government and the impact upon our Christian faith. And I knew he had testified in at least a couple of other pieces of litigation. And I don't remember if it was homeschool related or some other family oriented relationship. And that's how I determined to use him as one of four expert witnesses in that trial.
So why did you approach things from the need of an expert witness? What were you trying to accomplish? I understand what you were accomplishing by making it a class action suit so you could get things settled once and for all. What was the idea of bringing in an expert?
Well, you had the compulsory attendance law that was passed in 1917. And in it, it makes reference to the fact that a person in attendance at a private school where there's a course of study in good citizenship did not have to go to public school. And the reason for expert witnesses had to do with what did the legislature have in mind when it was talking about a private school in 1917. And that's where the expert witness came in. What was the situation with respect to children being educated at home? And that's going to require somebody who's done the research on home education. And the four expert witnesses that I had were real good on home education in general in the United States, but only one of them was extremely knowledgeable of home education in Texas, and that was Dr. Rush Dooney.
Yet he had never lived in Texas.
No, but he had spent time in Texas, and he had studied a lot of letters and other communications at that period of time during that second decade of the 20th century. And he was extremely familiar with what was going on at the time of the passage of that act, and then also at the time of the passage of an amendment to it a few years later. And that's what was critical. And when the case came on for trial, what was interesting was God caused Dr. Rush Dooney to miss his airplane and not be able to come in for the first day of trial.
Oh, you had planned for him to be your first witness?
Yeah. And well, okay. Not exactly the first witness, but the first expert witness.
That's what I meant, yes. Okay.
And Dr. Rush Dooney never misses an airplane, but he missed that one. And so I'm thinking, okay, either God doesn't want him for this case, or he's got another schedule in mind. Well, we put our three expert witnesses on, and their testimony, while great on home education in general, when they were asked specifically about their knowledge of home education in Texas, they couldn't get real specific. And when they were asked questions about the Alamo, they knew in general about the Alamo, but they didn't have a clue the details concerning that. Mm-hmm. And after those three expert witnesses had testified, it was very apparent to me that Dr. Rush Dooney definitely needed to come in. And the case had started on Monday, and he came in on Wednesday and testified.
So was he what you had hoped for?
No, he wasn't really what I'd hoped for. He was way beyond it. In fact, I couldn't have even imagined how well he was going to do. I knew that he would do well, but it's one of the few times in my legal career where I have seen a witness destroy the attorney trying to examine him, and he really tore apart the opposition law counsel. In fact, he taught them more about Texas history than they thought they knew, and that was one of the things that made his testimony so effective. The questions that they had used on the three experts, he showed them how that their question was flawed on Texas history, and he straightened them out on Texas history. And it was very, very enlightening. And I was watching the judge while all that was going on, and he was having difficulty containing himself from laughing at the education Dr. Rush Dooney was giving the Attorney General of Texas. Well, if not the Attorney General, but an Assistant Attorney General.
Right. Well, before I let you outline some of the specifics that I heard you recount in your video, there's two things I want to ask. One is, did Dr. Rush Dooney have the benefit of seeing any of the transcripts from the other expert witnesses before he actually went on the stand to talk?
He did not.
He did not. And did is not. Is there some legal thing that you weren't allowed to tell him what happened or what you thought was going to be needed, or you thought that the the attorney had sort of taken apart your witnesses in that area, or did he just sort of appear and go on?
No, I told him the trouble that the other expert witnesses had had. Mm-hmm. And he said that he appreciated me alerting him to those questions that would be coming. But no, I had no problem telling him, but everything that they would have testified to, he would have known anyhow, so there wasn't any reason for him to know in detail what they testified to, because the facts on home education across the United States among these witnesses, I mean, they were the same. It's almost as if they were reading the same script, and none of them had talked to each other.
Okay. All right. So now tell us what it was like when this know-it-all attorney decided he was going to make marshmallows out of this bearded, white-haired man.
Well, after he asked his question about Santa Ana, in which Dr. Rushdoony took him back to when this area of the United States was controlled by Spain before Mexico revolted against Spain, and Mexico became its own sovereign nation. He let him know that when Spain controlled Texas and the area that's now Mexico, they were controlled by two different departments. They were not under the same department. And the area of Texas had never been under the control of Mexico City. And when Santa Ana came from Mexico City into Texas to impose his will here, to some degree he was considered a foreign invader coming into an area that had never been subjected to Mexico City. And the Attorney General didn't know that, but he did after Dr. Rushdoony got through explaining to him some of the dynamics that took place in Santa Ana coming into Texas to invoke his will. But Dr. Rushdoony then went on to explain that during the second decade of the 20th century, that well over 60% of the children in Texas were being educated at home. They weren't being educated in public schools. And at the time, the statute was passed talking about a private school. There weren't even any private academies in Texas, so the word private school couldn't have referred to what we today think of a school that's outside the home, that's not state supported, and that the only meaning that it could have meant was a home school. Otherwise, the people who passed the statute, many of whom were educating their children at home, would have been putting their children in violation of the law when they passed the act, and they weren't that stupid. So they understood that private school meant a home school, and there was no historical evidence to contradict Dr. Rushdoony on that key point. In fact, that was the controlling fact that established that the language of the statute clearly encompassed a home school, and to prosecute people for being in express compliance with the statute was ludicrous.
Well, you said that the judge was finding it humorous. What was the attorney like as Dr. Rushdoony was giving him a history lesson?
Well, when he asked him about the Alamo, that's when Dr. Rushdoony went back into history and explained to him what it was all about. And when he got through, there were no more history questions coming from the Attorney General.
I see. And then you said, if I recall correctly, he started impugning his beliefs on creation versus evolution?
You know, I don't remember that portion of the testimony.
Okay.
That may very well be in that record, but I don't recall it. His initial was to try to shake his thoroughness of his research and his factual information. He was totally unable to do that. But I don't remember. I do remember in a later suit that I used Dr. Rushdoony, and that was in connection with three seminaries that had brought suit against the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board. In that particular suit, the Attorney General did go after Dr. Rushdoony, trying to make him look like the village idiot, but the Attorney General was totally unsuccessful in that. In fact, he ended up the Attorney General looking like the village idiot.
I guess maybe I'm confusing the cases because I remember
There are two cases that he was an expert witness for me. One was the Tyndale case, where the state of Texas fined Tyndale $186,000 because it didn't have a license from the state to award degrees in theological subjects. And he was my expert witness in that case, as well as the homeschool case, which preceded it by probably about a decade.
Now, I imagine that there are plenty of people who serve the function of expert witnesses, and I imagine some are more pleasant to deal with than others on a professional and personal basis. How would you categorize Dr. Rushdoony's willingness to serve in the capacity that you needed him to serve?
An excellent professional, always Christ-like in what he did. He could be strong in his response. But even though he would be strong in his response, it was never unchristlike in a manner that anybody would be offended by it. His analytical ability, as I say, I've put on expert witnesses in many, many cases, and I've never had an expert witness in any case perform at the level that Dr. Rushdoony did. I mean, it was just incredible to see his command of the answers to the questions that he was asked and his ability to show the flawedness in the people asking the questions.
Now, I know that hearing from his son, who now runs CalCedon, that it was Dr. Rushdoony's perspective that he was going to finance his transportation to many of the cases that he would serve with because he considered it a very vital part of the CalCedon ministry. Were other attorneys in the area or in the country then, after seeing how he performed in this case and the other case you mentioned, were they eager for him to be expert witnesses for them as well?
Now, that I don't know. And I'm inclined to think that he probably was. But the interesting thing about the Leeper case in Texas, even though its judicial impact as far as being binding on the court stopped at the borders of Texas, after the victory that God gave in that case, it stopped prosecutions all across the United States and the other 49 states, even though they didn't have to. But they saw what happened in there and how it happened and what the reasoning was, and I'm inclined to think they didn't want to have to run a risk of running into that kind of declaratory judgment suit, because it was brought under the Civil Rights Act, and that being a federal statute, which would, of course, obviously be binding across the country. But it did. It stopped all the prosecutions of homeschoolers after Leeper came down.
Wow. Now, we've seen in the past couple of years where not only in our country, but in other countries around the world, the hand of the state is coming down hard again on homeschooling. Do you have an opinion as to why that is happening?
It's because of the fact that there's been so much time that's gone by since Leeper came down. A lot of people who are making those decisions are totally unaware of Leeper. I think that has to do with it in the United States. Now, as far as outside the United States, I think it's just a general antagonism that government has towards any education that it doesn't control, because it recognizes if it controls the education, it has a better chance of controlling the populace.
Now, we're talking decades ago that you and Dr. Rushdoony worked together in this effort. What's your opinion of the state of homeschooling today? Is it healthier than it was back then? Has it sort of plateaued? From a legal perspective, what do you think?
Well, we're not seeing the prosecutions like we saw back in the 80s, which from that standpoint, that's good. There are isolated prosecutions from time to time, but those generally get taken care of. Certainly in Texas, from time to time, you'll have somebody come into a district that's unfamiliar with Leeper, and once they get educated, then they follow Leeper and have no problem after that. But I would think that home education has continued to grow and flourish. I'm guessing, I'm not basing this on any empirical information, But based on information I've picked up from time to time, I think homeschooling today is probably significantly larger than it was in the 80s and will be continuing to grow.
Right. I often tell people there's the desire to obey God and to teach your children the tenets of the faith throughout all the subject matter. But then you can't deny the fact that public schools around the nation are doing such a terrible job and allowing such atrocious things that we almost should give them finder's fees for leading people in the direction of Christian schools or homeschools.
Oh, there's no question that the public schools are one of the driving forces for home education, but not everybody is going to have that as an option because it takes such a commitment from at least one of the parents to do that, preferably two, but at least one. And the failure of the public school system today compared to what it was in the 80s, I mean, the public school system in the 80s was performing better than it is today. Mm-hmm. I mean, today it is so abysmal, it's a disgrace.
Do you think there's anybody that you're aware of who could or has filled the shoes of R.J. Rushdooney when it comes to being prepared to serve in the capacity he did as an effective expert witness?
Not to my knowledge. Now, that's not to say that there's not one out there, but mm-hmm. that person hadn't come on my radar screen.
I often think that one of the products of the homeschool movement should be people who dedicate themselves to be as, maybe not exactly as he was, because we both would agree was a unique person, but to be prepared to step in and make the arguments that he made backed up by research and study so that instead of one person who's available for the task, there would be many.
Well, there are folks out there that, by and large, have a good grasp of things, but to the depth that he had it, I'm not aware of anybody out there that has it to that depth.
Another thing that I was impressed upon as you gave the story, and I grant you that Dr. Rushdooney was only a part of the whole case and how so many things came together, how your resolve in knowing that there's a sovereign God who will watch over obedient children was strengthened in all that, even to the point, as you mentioned earlier, that when he missed his plane, instead of deciding all was lost, you had the sense that God had a different agenda than you thought should be the agenda.
Oh, I could see God's hand on that case from the get-go. I mean, the way he put the case together, the way he took my mistakes and gave me direction and help sometime from the opposing counsel on getting it finally postured so that when it did go to trial, and then the rearranging of witnesses in the trial, then the explosion coming out of Helen Jackson that rocked the courtroom. Then when we go up on appeal, the state writes its brief. And 1 week after filing their brief, the Supreme Court of the United States blows the entire premise of the brief apart, and they have to rewrite their brief, plus the affirmance all the way up. No, God's hand, anybody who looks at that and says a human being could orchestrate all the events that took place in that, that's not possible. It's superintended by God.
And don't you think it also involves that as the participant in such an effort that you have to be able to envision the victory if you're proceeding knowing that what you're doing and what you're advocating is biblical, that instead of listening to the naysayers and all the people who say you can't win, that you know it's not in your strength anyway. It's God's project or it's not worth doing.
Well, let me put it this way. If you're called into litigation, the thing that you have to do as an attorney is to be faithful to what God would have you do and to be a living sacrifice for Him each step of the way. The ultimate outcome, you know what it should be, but you don't know for sure that it's going to happen because it doesn't always happen that way. And the classic example of that is Jesus in his trials. The outcome should have been he was completely vindicated, exonerated, and sent on his way. But here he's falsely convicted and put on a cross. Now, if the Son of God gets falsely convicted and gets a bad result in the courthouse, how can I, representing a client, say, God, you're a God of justice, I demand justice, and God turns around and says, well, what about my son? I don't have an answer for that, because the answer is, I can't demand it. Now, what's interesting is that, as a general rule, God will give a just result even from a judge that may give him no thought at all. But God is still in control of those Roman 13 deacons, which is what your civil court justices are.
I just think too often we walk by sight rather than faith, and from listening to your whole account, from how you were a reluctant participant in the first place and somebody brought you along and it became obvious to you that it was more important what God wanted than what you necessarily wanted, that we need to walk by faith, knowing that if we're obeying God, that's what we're supposed to do.
That's true. And while I was convinced from a legal point of view, if the court followed the law, we would win. God gave us a great trial judge who, I don't know that he was a believer, but he was an excellent, excellent judge, and he followed the law. And the Court of Appeals followed the law, and the Supreme Court followed it. And it was very clear. In fact, what was interesting is after the trial court was over with, the Assistant Attorney General who had tried the case told the Texas Board of Education that we should not appeal the case, leave it at the trial court level. And the board told the Assistant Attorney General, we want an appeal of the case, to which he responded, it's awfully hard to appeal in a case because you have to point out what's wrong with it, and I don't find anything wrong with it. And they said, well, find something. And that's where he came up with this idea that the Supreme Court of the United States blew apart a week after he filed his brief. And I thought that was very poetic justice.
Yeah, poor guy. You almost feel sorry for him.
Right, because he was really right. It was just he was taking orders from state officials that had a political agenda that they didn't care what the law was. They were wanting a political result.
And even to the assigning of that first judge, I remember in listening to your talk, you could have had any number of judges, and I think it happens on a sort of rotating basis. So there was you couldn't really request a judge. And God made sure that you had the judge who would hear the case in a just fashion.
That is correct. And it just so happened that the district clerk also happened to be a client of mine, because I had represented the district clerk and the sheriff and the tax assessor collector and the county clerk in a piece of litigation. And so when I took it to the district clerk, I said, you know, this thing's going to have a lot of political problems with it, and it sure does need to be in a court where the judge is not going to care who the parties are, but will decide it based on the law. And I said, if that should end up in Judge Murray's court in the 17th, that sure would be nice. And I just left it with the clerk. Somehow it ended up in the 17th, and I don't know what happened.
I like to tell people who feel that they're up against a wall and problems are insurmountable, or they don't have the finances for what they think God is calling them to do, I say, never forget that Mordecai was going to go to the gallows the next day, and God arranged for the king to have insomnia, request a bedtime story, and somebody read the story that saved Mordecai.
That's right. Well, the thing is, you know, God is totally and completely in control. Your only responsibility is to be faithful to him and what he's called you to do, and that's it. Everything else, you just praise God for whatever's going to happen, and that's exactly what happened in homeschool. We praised him for the victory, because while people from time to time have complimented me and said that was a nice victory that you got, I said, hey, God got the victory. He gave me a good chair to watch it happen.
And something that makes this interview something I'm very grateful for, we discovered that there was no real record anywhere of Dr. Rushdoony's participation in these various efforts. He certainly didn't toot his own horn.
No, he didn't. And
I am oftentimes representing Calcedon at homeschool conventions, and people will walk up and say, who is this Rushdoony? And I said, well, in a very real sense, like I said at the outset, he's considered the father of the movement because of his groundbreaking work. But you're able to be here, and there are all these options because of work he did around the time where you probably didn't even have children yet, to lay the groundwork. And it wasn't just for homeschools. You had mentioned that there were other cases he was involved with, and those were the cases involving Christian schools.
Correct.
So he was very active, but he really was on God's mission, because even knowing him as long as I did, I'd have to pull this kind of information out of him. He wasn't really ready to tell you all about it.
No. He was a very, very humble man, and when he was in a battle and it was over with, that's history. He's focused on what God's got for him right now. He's not thinking about what took place in the past. The past only comes up if it's a part of a presentation he's needing to make in the present.
Right.
That's the only way it ever came up.
Well, we can thank God for his providence in supplying us at a time in the latter part of the 20th century with somebody with such depth and breadth of knowledge. And I'd encourage my listeners to get a hold of those two books that are available via Chalcedon, Intellectual Schizophrenia and the Messianic Character of American Education, to really solidify your own philosophical perspective on why it's important to have Christian education. Shelby, thank you so much. I've enjoyed this, and God bless all the future efforts you have in the homeschool arena and outside the homeschool arena.
And thank you very much, and I do commend your listeners. Those two books are even more timely today than when they were written. They really need to be read, and they need to be acted upon.
You can find those books at www.calcedonstore.com. Join me again next time for another edition of the Law and Liberty Podcast.